How you all doing? You having fun?
Woo!
Welcome to this review of Trap, part of the Percolated Media M. Night Shyamalan Retrospective Series.
Thank you. Thank you. This is literally the best day of my life.
Join Garrett.
I gotta go to the bathroom.
And Matt.
He's going to try to cause chaos.
As they bring Mike Guarneri back to the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast in order to continue their look at the auteur's director's dramatic films.
No dad jokes, this is serious.
Does M. Night's new movie slap?
Is it slap, Dad?
Find out next, courtesy of Percolated Media.
Let's clear out and give us some space.
Trap. Release August 2nd, 2024. Budget $30 million. Box office so far $46.1 million. And this is directed and written by M. Night Shyamalan. Matt, 2.5 years and a slew of movies after we start this thing with helping get this site launched with Knock at the Cabin. Here we are talking more M. Night. Did you think we'd be talking about him this soon?
Yes, because as soon as Knock at the Cabin came out, he was already doing pre-production on this. I guess you can do that when you're financing a lot of these movies yourself, and it's not like other studios are having to put hundreds of millions of dollars when you look at the box office / budget comparison for this and Knock at the Cabin. So I am a little perturbed that we've done 2 Shyamalan movies on this platform before we've even touched Hitchcock.
Well, I mean, in fairness, Hitchcock's last movie was a while back. I remember seeing that one in theater.
And, Mike, sir, you are back. After we closed the book on Bad Boys for now, here you are about 2 months later to talk more M. Night. How about you? Did you think we would get more M. Night this early?
Oh, yeah. He's turning them out. That's how he does it these days. And so I'm glad to be back discussing, you know, the original Bad Boy himself, M. Night.
An original Bad Boy. In some people's eyes, for sure. And the three of us have taken some shots at him over the years. We did a whole series on him back at the old place. Shows that I'm trying to get back. Keep those hopes up. We'll get those up eventually. And here we are, 2.5 years later with Trap. This one really snuck up on me, I gotta say. The only reason I knew this was coming out was because Josh Hartnett was all over my Facebook feed, because apparently the algorithms got to me, and they knew that I was watching M. Night movies over the years, and they're throwing this in my face. But I went in this completely cold. I didn't see any fucking trailers on this. Thank God I didn't. I shouldn't say I was excited for it, but one thing about M. Night movies, and Matt, we've discovered this, is they get people talking. And when I saw this the week of release, I didn't really say my thoughts because I like saving my thoughts for when we get on these podcasts. But Matt, a guy you and I used to work for, went on and said this is the worst movie he'd seen all year. I've seen a whole bunch of people say that this was one of their favorites of the year. What were you expecting going in, Matt?
No clue. If anything, I was expecting to be surprised one way or another. Shyamalan has become, ever since, basically since he broke onto the scene with The Sixth Sense, and we talked about this on the old retro, you never know what you're going to get. Even though his track record, he's made more bad movies than good, I'm always genuinely excited to see what he's going to make, except for Lady in the Water, which I have said numerous things about, and Knock at the Cabin I hate for other reasons, not because I was not excited for it. The only marketing I saw for this was the first trailer because it was playing in front of something. I had no control. I wasn't going to leave the theater for 2.5 minutes. So I knew the gist, the quote-unquote twist, if you even want to call it that, which I dispute vehemently for people who claim that the trailers ruined the twist. No, they just gave you the premise of the movie. There's a huge difference, and we need to have a complete conversation about what spoilers actually mean nowadays, because I don't view this as a spoiler, and I'm not surprised by the divisive reaction, because when was the last time Shyamalan released a movie that was universally liked? And even the movies he's made that are panned repeatedly, stuff like The Happening, it's got a fan base that love it unironically.
For sure. Mike, what about you? What were you expecting going to the theater? Had you seen trailers going in? Did you know the gist of what was going on like Matt did?
I knew that there was a film where Josh Hartnett He's a single father. Well, he's not a single father. He's a father. He's taking his young daughter to this concert. But at the concert, he finds out that things might be a little more complicated than they initially let on. But I was actually really excited for this. I thought that the trailer, which I remember seeing, I think it just dropped on the internet and I just watched it. And I just remember thinking it was such a goofy premise. And I mean that in an entirely positive way. It's just a real... I wanted to know how he got out of the trap. Like, I just was like, oh, don't spoil it for me. I need to go in fresh. There's that episode of Seinfeld where everyone's trying to get Elaine to watch The English Patient. And she's like, but what about Sack Lunch, another movie? She's like, what about Sack Lunch? Don't you want to know how they get into the sack? That's the way that I was with this. Like, people were telling me to see other things. And I was like, I kind of want to see how he gets out of the trap. So I was excited for this. But I also knew, like he said, with M. Night, there's a real grab bag quality to it. Even on a scene-by-scene basis, which we'll get into. A
couple things about this is, you know, M. Night picked a great year to release this. Because this really is the year of the singer, if you think about it. Because...
Is it?
One of the most successful movies of the year was a fucking concert movie done by Taylor Swift earlier this year. So I found that ironic that he's kind of trying to capitalize on that. And two, this is quite a year for the Shyamalan family because, boys, did any of you guys watch his daughter's movie, Watchers, from earlier this year?
I didn't.
No, I didn't see that.
I wanted to, but it came and went so quickly. And I thought, honest to God, it was like an unofficial sequel to The Village. Because it looks so much like it that I almost thought Shyamalan pitched it to his daughter as an unofficial sequel so that way he could not take the blame for it sucking if it failed.
And apparently it did.
Yeah, that's what I keep hearing, which is, you know, I would have been spurred to see it if it got lambasted. But everyone I know who's seen it, which is, I think I can count on one hand the amount of people I know who actually saw it, just went, meh.
That's kind of what I heard, too, was that it was kind of middle of the road. Like, it wasn't really good, it wasn't really bad. And the thing about Shyamalan's movies is it inspires passion, and it didn't seem like there was any passion one way or the other with Watchers, which was kind of the way... What was that elevator movie he did?
Devil.
Yeah, when he produced Devil, it was kind of the same way with that, where people weren't really... They didn't say it was really good, they didn't say it was really bad, they just thought it was okay, and that's kind of the gist I got from Watchers.
To your point about... this premise. The one thing, and it being kind of gimmicky, that's been his calling card really since The Visit, which is kind of the second act of his career now, or act three, I guess you would call Wide Awake through, I don't know, Signs as act one, and then The Village is where the turn starts, although for me it's Signs. But The Village on, all those movies you can explain in one sentence, and it makes it sound like a ridiculous B-movie. Go to live with their crazy grandparents. Woman trapped in a crazy guy's basement who has multiple personalities. People go on a beach and age rapidly. Superhero movie taking place in an insane asylum. And bunch of preachers assault a gay couple and their child on vacation. This, it's serial killer goes to concert that is ultimately a trap to get him.
Wait, the concert was a trap?
That was the twist.
That was the twist, yeah. Mike. We will get into it, sir. Did you see this movie? I'm asking.
I saw it.
Okay. So let's get a little bit of the backstory here. You know, for about 9 years now, Shyamalan had been working with Universal pretty exclusively, working with Blumhouse and whatnot. But with this one, he decided to go with Warner Brothers. He wrote the script in 5.5 months, which for him was a personal record. And he based it on, you know, him and his daughter. This is so M. Night. Him and his daughter, one of their favorite movies is Purple Rain. So his whole premise was to make kind of a musical movie with the music being not really, it's not being done to the music, but the music plays a pretty good background presence in it. And the premise of the movie when he pitched it, as he called it, was Silence of the Lambs at a Taylor Swift concert, which is great on paper, but we'll talk about whether that comes to fruition or not.
God, even with him saying that, I don't see that in the finished product.
Same here. I thought about that. Like I mentioned, I didn't see any press or anything before I went into this, because, by the way, he didn't have press screenings for this. There were no press screenings for this whatsoever.
Which is weird, I think.
Yeah.
It didn't even get awful reviews or anything like that. Like, it, you know, it got mixed
reviews. They've been middling.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is how his movies have gotten reviewed for the past 20 years. So, I mean, it's... You know.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's basically middling is his high bar when it comes to and then it's all downhill from there based upon which one you stand on. But the fact that this was embargoed scared the living daylights out of me because I was worried this was going to be back to the last Airbender era of Shyamalan where everything he made is just irredeemable crap for the most part.
Yeah, and it seemed like him going to Warner Brothers was kind of him also kind of getting that ego trip a little bit. You know, like he didn't need Blumhouse to work his projects anymore, so now he was going to go to this big studio to kind of help him along. But
yeah, it's like an NFL draft trade where Nolan goes to Universal for Oppenheimer and Shyamalan goes to Warner Brothers for this.
Well, I was going to say, supposedly M. Night was a big factor in talking to Nolan when he was doing his Oppenheimer little kind of auction of all the different studios were trying to lure him out. Apparently one of the factors was M. Night was like, hey, Universal's very good with directors, gives them a lot of freedom and stuff. And then, you know, Nolan signs with Universal and then if he goes to Warner Brothers, I don't really know what that was about. But I think maybe Warner's just trying to get some of their cred. I don't know if that was quite the way to do it, but, you know, oh well.
Well, M. Night, along with Nolan, it's funny you mentioned Nolan, like they are two directors that you could sell just based on their name. In fact, when I finished watching this, I did watch a couple of trailers for it. They don't mention Josh Hartnett at all. This is all M. Night all over these trailers, which also kind of, if I would have seen him in theaters, it would have kind of scared me a little bit.
Well, there's only a handful of directors nowadays where their name alone will sell the movie. Those two, Jordan Peele, I think, has fallen into that now. In a lot of ways, Jordan Peele is starting to follow the Shyamalan trajectory. I just hope his next movie isn't The Village. Because if it is, we're in big trouble.
All right, so let's talk about our theatrical experiences. I was actually able to go to a Thursday screening of this. I watched it the Thursday before the Friday it opened. And you know what, man? I got to say, Matt, we talked about Furiosa earlier this year. This movie was pretty well attended at that screening. I would say that thing was a little more than halfway full when I saw this, and this was a Thursday screening at 3:00. So I found that interesting, and I went by myself. Again, my bride-to-be was like, you go ahead and go. You check that out. So she was not even going to touch this with a 10-foot pole. Mike, how did you see this, sir? How was your screening of this?
So I went on the last Tuesday that I saw it, I went to go see Twisters, and then when I was there, I was noticing there weren't any actual tornadoes in the movie, and so I went outside and I asked the concessions guy, I was like, hey, what's going on? And he told me that the movie was a trap. Okay, I should stop doing that. I thought that was funny, though. But no, I went to go see it on Half Price Tuesday, which is probably the way to see this, and walked down there, and it was pretty full, actually. I guess that's what happens on your Half Price Tuesdays. Could not convince my girlfriend to go with me. That's her first name check on this podcast. This was a solo outing, and saw it, you know, by myself. Pretty packed theater. It was the last show of the night, too. It was like a 9:50 show, so it was, you know, pretty late. So, good crowd, like, big crowd.
Yeah, I was not expecting that when I went to see this, honestly. So that makes 0-for-2 on people whose spouses did not go with them to this movie, or seconds, plus
partners,
twos.
Yeah.
Partners, yeah. What about you, Matt? How did you see this? You see this alone? You see this in a packed theater? How was your experience?
Well, I'll keep the zero win streak alive. The theater, well, I went on a Friday night, so I think that's always going to skew your attendees by about 10-20%.
Yeah.
Even still, it was close. I'd say 3/4 of the way full.
Wow. An animated crowd?
Relatively speaking, yeah, but I say that in a respectful way because I didn't see a whole lot of phones flashing outside of on screen during some of the concert sequences.
All right. So let's go ahead and get into this movie. We start off with some emblems and an opening credit sequence that was certainly different. You know, guys, I'm trying to remember the last time I saw a movie start off with an actual opening credit sequence as opposed to just displaying them while the movie's going on. It's been a while since I've seen that.
I'm sure I could come through my memory banks and think of some, but I'm so sick of, and I bitch about this every time, I don't need to see 6 logos in front of every goddamn that I go to see.
interesting opening. I was wondering, like, you know, how he was going to set it up. I was a little surprised that the song wasn't one of Lady Raven's songs.
It was.
I don't know who it was, actually.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was on the radio.
And sort of setting up, you know, M. Night, he loves Philadelphia, so he gives us the, you know, the streets, the map of the streets and everything like that. It was an interesting beginning. It was not, actually, you know, like, I was thinking about how good the opening credit sequence to Split is,
mm-hmm.
with the sort of the, like, fragmented sort of angles and split screens, the sort of Psycho-esque kind of opening to that movie, and how much that kind of sets the sort of monster movie tone of that. And then this was just kind of a little strange. Not good, bad, or just, you know, just it was not what I expected.
And for me, I look at this opening credit sequence, I think it's really to get us in the mood for this film, because contrary to what Mike thinks, yes, this was a Lady Raven song. Songs that were composed by M. Night's daughter herself, as well as, I think they had a producer. So I do think it's to get us in the mood for this. But we're meeting who we're going to eventually know as Riley. She's singing the song from the credits when we first meet Cooper, played by Josh Hartnett. So let's talk about these two. Now, this Ariel Donahue, I hadn't seen her in anything. Apparently she's in Wolf Like Me. Not somebody I'm familiar with. Now, Hartnett, he has had a little bit of a career renaissance. Last year he was in Oppenheimer, and Matt, when we reviewed that movie, we said we kind of liked his presence in that, and after that movie was out, M. Night kind of interviewed Hartnett, and he really liked the fact that, you know, they both had three kids, and they both kind of the same life going on with for themselves, and so M. Night thought he would be perfect for this role. I think Hartnett does a pretty good job. There are a couple instances where I'm kind of iffy on him. We'll get to those when we get to him, but I really like Hartnett in this role.
I thought he was great, and I'm not somebody who's usually been a Hartnett person, you know, in the past. Like, for me, I've always usually thought of him as, like, this really bland, kind of cut-and-paste leading man from the early 2000s when they were really just struggling to find good leading man. Like, they're putting Ryan Phillippe and stuff, and, like, thinking about, like, him in, like, Pearl Harbor, just, like, complete, just kind of wooden, dead, and, like, Hollywood Homicide with Harrison Ford, where it's just, like, such a gulf between,
yeah.
like, this once amazing movie star who is, like, not trying at all, and then this guy who just does not, at least at the time, you know, did not have the chops. And then it seemed like the Josh Hartnett experiment kind of ran its course. He actually, this is one of those things that, like, it kind of slipped under the radar a little bit, but he basically stopped doing Hollywood movies for about 14 years. After 30 Days of Night, which no one remembers, in 2007, he doesn't appear in another Hollywood, like, American wide release movie, not like a direct-to-video thing, an actual movie that you can go to see at a Regal theater, until the Guy Ritchie Wrath of Man movie.
Oh, that's right.
And then, and that was 2021, so 14 years without basically doing the, like, the Rick Dalton, like, thing of, like, going off and making weird, you know, little, like, small budget movies.
I've forgotten he was in Wrath of Man.
Wrath of Man, and then the fucking, the other fucking Guy Ritchie, the Operation Fortune one.
Oh, wow.
Which is a whole other story. But, and then Oppenheimer, and I thought he was very good in Oppenheimer, although that was also one of those cases where I remember a lot of people, like, praising him, and I'm like, is he good, or is he just in a good movie
yeah.
for the first time in years?
Exactly.
But this one, he, I think, completely vindicates himself as an actor. The comparison I kept making in my head was to James McAvoy and Split, in terms of previous M. Night movies that are in many ways like star vehicles for a guy who is not an A-lister, but someone who people know and recognize, him getting a chance to do on a lower budget something that is flashy and dramatic and has lots of twists and turns and a lot of screen time, and him, I think, really acquitting himself. We'll talk about all the different sort of permutations that the character is going to go through over the rest of the film, but I remember thinking, like, from the minute that he was on, he was locked in, and that continued whatever the other issues were with the movie for the runtime of the film. So I gotta say, like, Josh Hartnett, I'm not gonna say you were good in Pearl Harbor or something like that, but you've got talent for sure, and you did a great job.
What?
So there you go. If you're listening, Josh, and I know you are, you did a great job.
Wow. So Hartnett vindicated himself for Guarneri. Matt, what about you, sir?
Well, I've been a proud card-carrying member of the Josh Hartnett hate club for God knows how long. It's funny, Pearl Harbor, I think he had the Ben Affleck problem for a very long time. Big guy, good-looking, but not much in the way of being like a quote-unquote Hollywood leading man. And I think his like only good role for a long time was The Faculty when he was playing a teenager, even though he was like 20, had the 90210 problem. And every time he tried to play a tough guy, it failed spectacularly. Black Hawk Down, Hollywood Homicide, Lucky Number 7. I don't know if anybody saw that movie.
The Bruce Willis one?
Nope.
Yeah. I remember that one.
I used to think he was just a terrible actor, and then I was a big fan of the show Penny Dreadful, and he played the Wolfman on that, and I thought he was actually, that's kind of what made me realize, oh, okay, maybe he does have some actual talent. And it is a bit advantageous with television, you get more time to flesh out your characters. As far as him in this movie, the McAvoy comparison is what permeated my brain, because he is, much like McAvoy, he has to play a lot of different levels in this movie. There's parts where he goes very big. There's parts where he over-accentuates some of his facial expressions, and there's parts where he's surprisingly menacing and downplaying. The problem is he's still being directed by M. Night Shyamalan. And there are so many moments in this movie where he's trying his damnedest, but between Shyamalan's directing choices and the way he writes dialogue, I find it distracting. Like, Split, I think, works because McAvoy in that whole movie is designed to be a showcase for his acting ability. Here, I don't feel like he's doing the same thing for Josh Hartnett, but Hartnett is actually, I think, actually elevating some of the writing. But Shyamalan's more preoccupied with other stuff in this movie, so it doesn't feel like a showcase performance. My last point is, if you would have told me in an M. Night Shyamalan movie that Josh Hartnett would give a better performance than Mark Wahlberg, I would not have believed you 20 years ago. Because in a lot of ways, their early roles were pretty similar. Mm-hmm. Like, they could have easily been one and the same. The only difference is Mark Wahlberg kept getting chance after chance after chance, whereas Josh Hartnett kind of, whether it was self-exile or some other things, kind of fell off the face of the planet. And I hope this movie's ultimate fate, mixed perception, does not stop Josh Hartnett's comeback, because I feel like that would be a shame.
Well, it's made more than its budget, so it's not a total failure. Especially, I mean, it opened, what, like the second weekend that Wolverine and Deadpool opened? So I don't think it's a total failure, but I don't see it being the massive moneymakers that M. Night Shyamalan has cranked out over the years.
It's a little more expensive than some of his most recent ones.
For sure.
Which has been kind of been his business model, is make them cheap and get enough anticipation that, you know, enough people see it basically first weekend. That's all that you need, really. And this one's a little bit more expensive than his recent one, so it needs to make a little bit more money to be, like, a success. This is not a Borderlands.
I was just about ready to say, it's not Borderlands.
Yeah, no.
But it's also not, I don't think it's going to make the money something like The Visit did.
Yeah.
No.
So when we cut to the car, we see Riley, she's singing away, and Hartnett's saying that he's not going to be breaking any laws to get to the concert, but they'll get there soon, trust me. Riley says maybe she'll be a singer, and Cooper sarcastically says, yeah, maybe. Now this goes with the theme with this film, and I'm going to be pointing these out as we go, but every character in this movie is kind of trapped in some way, starting with Riley here. She's revealing to her dad that she wants to be a singer, and she gets sarcasm, not encouragement, in return. Mike, did you see those parallels as we go further into the film?
I hadn't quite thought of it in those terms. What interests me about the structure of this film that works, I think, very well until it doesn't, and then it becomes a pretty big problem, is how, in order to escape the trap, Cooper has to trap himself a little bit more. Increasingly, as the film goes on, that's kind of that becomes the structure of it, is that in order to get out of the situation, this wide situation, he has to get into a position where he's literally, you know, on stage, you know what I mean,
uh-huh,
with and like spotlighted, basically. In order to go unnoticed, he has to be noticed, which I think is really, like, very clever. But like I said, it's clever and it works until it stops working, which is what we're going to eventually end up discussing.
That's not something I picked up on, but now that you say it, it does somewhat recontextualize, and to Mike's point, it works up until it doesn't.
Yeah.
And I was also thinking about this, now that you mentioned that, what's sort of interesting is the daughter at no point, what's her name, Riley?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Riley at no point, she's never the point of view character. in this entire movie, which I think is maybe a mistake, but not, I don't think that's the movie's problem or anything. But Cooper's the point of view character at first, and seemingly I thought it was going to be for the entire film, and then in the back half of it, it chooses to highlight two different characters as the point of view figure back to back, but at no point does Riley become that, and all three are, like, yeah, trapped in different ways. That's right. I hadn't quite thought of it in those terms, but it makes sense. And I hadn't quite thought about how Riley is not part of that until just now. So everyone's listening to my Eureka moment right now.
So they run to the building doing things that a father and daughter do right before a huge concert, you know, grabbing a bite to eat, grabbing something to drink. And the scene of Lady Raven getting out of the car, surrounded by bodyguards, I'll never forget, Matt. I went to a wrestling event with my dad when I was like 10 years old, and I got to see Piper enter the building like this. I was kind of having flashbacks of this as I was watching it. So Cooper tells Riley to not let people fool her through life as they're moving through the building. And Riley also reveals that she's been getting bullied at school. Again, she's feeling trapped.
And the script is trapped in neutral. Because this is accentuated, it's made a plot point. There's confrontation about it, but there's no resolution or direct answer as to why she's being bullied.
Oh, I don't think that matters, because it's just, whatever it is, it's some stupid 13-year-old shit.
Yeah, it's heightened and it's accentuated so much that if that was the payoff, that it was just teenage girls being teenage girls, that would have been genuinely funny.
I think the payoff is when she gets on stage later, and that's kind of the in-your-face moment that she has. That's the only thing I can think of.
No, yeah, totally.
So Cooper pulls out his phone and takes a picture of Riley singing, and then Cooper gets in trouble for saying jelly as we cut to a tracking shot of them entering the concert. Cooper reveals the seats they got, and he tells her that it's because of her good grades that he went and got these really good seats for her. So again, at this point, again, I hadn't seen the trailers, but I feel at this point he's being a good dad. And I think maybe there's another serial killer roaming around. I didn't think it would be him. So I'm glad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I didn't know a thing, boys, going in. When I say I went in blind, I went in completely blind. Riley reveals what crispy means, something I had no idea about. And then
this is one of those instances where this movie was written by someone who doesn't understand modern teenagers.
Yes. Although I do think he probably got some advice from his daughter, maybe, on this stuff. But the way it is shot and acted is really awkward. I'll give it that.
I feel like I have to say one thing, which is a huge... I've been to a lot of concerts recently.
Not to brag.
So the thing that I was like, whoa, what's going on with this, is that this is a daytime concert, which doesn't happen. I mean, unless you're at a festival, there's no situation where someone does a big pop star would do a daytime concert. And at first I thought that was just a thing where, you know, they would rather film it, especially because there's a lot of children involved as extras. They'd rather film it in the daytime than the nighttime. And you just kind of have to accept it, which I thought would be, you know, understandable. Like when you, like in TV shows when they have kids trick-or-treating and it's like not even dark out and you're like, okay, I get it, but still. And then they end up going out back to the house for dinner and I'm like, whoa, hold on. This would be 2 a.m. I went to the Arrow Store. I didn't get home till 4 a.m., okay? You guys, this doesn't happen. But anyways.
You went to the Arrow Store?
That's my biggest problem with this movie.
You went to the Arrow Store?
Oh, I did, oh, and I'm going to have a hard time explaining that one to the student loan people, why I was able to pay for that and not...
Interesting. See, what I took that as is maybe this is a summer concert and it's starting at 5, but at the same time there's no opening act, and by the time they get out it's dark outside, so yeah, you have a point there.
That's my point. There's no opening act, there's nothing. She just walks on stage and the sun is not even close to setting.
Yeah, that's a good point. So as we mentioned, no opening act as the stage is taken up by Lady Raven herself, played by M. Night's daughter, Salika. Now, this girl has to go through a lot in the final third of this movie, which we'll get to, but for the first two-thirds, she's pretty much just playing up a Taylor Swift-type pop star. Alright guys, how do we feel she does in this portion of the film? We'll get to the third act, but for now, how do we think she does with the stage presence and whatnot?
You're underselling it with the words pretty much, because I can't believe the same guy who made a movie that was nepotism personified in After Earth managed to up the ante with his own kid. This is disgusting. The trap is we paid money to watch him showcase his daughter on America's Got Talent for 105 minutes. And the biggest problem, on top of the blatant nepotism alone, is that the concert overshadows the premise of the movie. The concert is not built around the movie. The movie's built around the fucking concert. And it pisses me off to no end. Is she musically inclined? Yes. This was not the right project to showcase that. And there are too many moments, if you think I'm being over-exaggerating, she performs, what, seven, eight songs, and they're extended musical sequences.
See, this is, I disagree with you on this one.
Oh, my fucking God.
Because
I just did The Last Jedi, for Christ's sake. I don't want to keep fighting with fucking people.
Well, here's what I think. So, as far as I'm concerned, like, I think that this movie is kind of about, when I say about, I don't mean, like, thematically. I just mean, what is it that's, like, animating this thing? And what's animating it is, like, yes, nepotism, but also the idea of, like, being at a concert and feeling a little bit out of place. And I think that's probably happened to anybody who's been to more than a couple concerts. You go to one, you go, oh, I'm a little too old to be at this, or, oh, I'm a little too young to be at this, or, oh, I'm not the gender that most of the audience is, or these people seem like more real punks than I am, and I'm the faker. That's a thing that is very real, is being in a situation where you're in a place where there's thousands and thousands of people and everyone's looking at one stage, but you feel like they're looking at you because you feel a little bit out of place.
Yeah, but
and I feel like that is the basic thing that's animating this movie. I don't know who M. Night had to take to a concert. I don't know if it was one of his kids, if this is an idea he's had for a while, and like the attention of the Eras Tour kind of like brought that to his, you know, mind again or whatever, but to me, this is a movie that comes from a guy taking his daughter to a concert where the vast majority of the people in the building are 13-year-old girls, and he's like, I feel like I'm not supposed to be here and everyone knows it. And so for me, having the performances on stage, they really have to be a central part of the movie because that would be overwhelming. If you're at one of these concerts, everything about the performance, the pyrotechnics, the music, the sound, everything is all pointed and coming from one person. And that's where all the energy is coming from and going to. And so that's really got to be central. It can't just be like some background thing. It really, and my actual problem, I think, is that I don't think that the music and the performances are quite spectacular enough to really justify it. I think that they seem to be pretty competent songs. I wasn't really getting into any of them, but I don't think that that makes them necessarily bad. I just wasn't, they weren't really like sparking for me. I don't think that Saleka Shyamalan is, I noticed this. I went to the Eras Tour, big fan. People who are huge pop stars are good on the mic, generally, in terms of stage presence, in terms of how they interact with the crowd, in terms of being able to hold your attention even when they're not singing. And the first warning signs of what was going to come up later with Saleka Shyamalan was that as good as her voice as a singer was, she was not owning the stage when she was on there. And I think that I see what the idea was, like, let me develop this with my daughter who's a singer, but this is one where I'm like, I feel like the star needed to be, the musical star, the pop star, needed to have more of the star quality in order to kind of balance it.
This would work if you had someone with actual stage presence like a Tina Turner, or don't use Purple Rain as your reference because Prince has 10 times the screen presence that she does. You could certainly have the concerts be more of a focal point, but you can't get past the nepotism. And it's a good thing that she has Knight in her name because her music was putting me to sleep.
Let me ask you this.
It sounds like what I would hear on my drive home from work on like iHeartRadio, where I'm like, it's okay, but it's in one ear out the other.
Matt, let me ask you this. Who would you put in this role?
I'd have to do Taylor Swift, actually.
Well, yeah, she was a little busy, though.
Lady Gaga. You know, someone like a Lady Gaga who's got screen presence and can actually act. Although I don't think they could have afforded her, certainly.
No.
But
that's kind of the problem, yeah.
If that corporate stooge Todd Phillips can afford her, then I'm sure M. Night Shyamalan can.
Yeah, see, that's what I was kind of thinking of. Because I'm with Matt here, where I was not liking the fact that he put her in this movie. And I thought she was okay on the stage. Like, and unlike Mike, I will say, I think the work they put into the stage show with the smoke and the red filter and things, I think it's okay. But I'm with you, Mike. When I look at her, I don't see the stage presence that somebody like a Lady Gaga would have, which is what this movie needs for where it needs to go. So
yeah.
That's where I stand. But then, the more I was thinking about it, I was like, who would I put? Lady Gaga? Well, I could, but guess what? She's doing Joker of Folly, so that's not happening. Like, who would you put in this role?
If you want someone a little bit younger, Selena Gomez?
Maybe.
I mean, I could sit here and name a bunch of pop stars that I like, but the question is, can they act?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And if they can't act, then what would they be doing in, like, a supporting role in a $30 million M. Night Shyamalan movie? Kind of, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Not to be too mean or anything like that, but you're not going to get Lady Gaga to do this. You know what I mean? She's an Oscar nominee. So that's kind of the issue. Maybe there's someone from the Disney school who hasn't quite broken out yet. You know what I mean? Like a pre-2021 mm-hmm. Olivia Rodrigo. You guys are going to get me on a puppy.
But
radical. I need to step away from.
I mean, look, she's got more talent than Jaden Smith has ever possessed. But I think while his intent, much like Knock at a Cabin, his intentions were good, the execution is just extremely misguided and forced.
Yeah, and this makes the third Shyamalan we've seen this year too. Which, man, that's a lot of Shyamalans this year.
What are the other two?
Well, we have M. Night, and we had his daughter do the movie earlier this year. So.
That's right, and now we have the unholy trinity.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, to quote the Undertaker. I mean, look, but also to be fair, like this concert has the technical prowess of an independent wrestling show. Like, it's fine.
Cooper says he needs to use the restroom, and he tells Riley to stay in her seat. But when he goes in the red doored stall, he takes out his phone again, only this time is to look at a kid chained up. And me, coming into this as cold as I did, had no idea what this meant. But this was the first sign of Cooper not being the nice family dad we meet at the beginning. So I thought this was actually pretty well done.
Yeah, I could see how if you have not seen any of the marketing, this would genuinely take you by surprise. And I think this is executed very well. And I'm glad that Shyamalan opened the door earlier instead of keeping this in his mystery box
exactly.
For the end.
Yeah.
Where it's like, if you see the marketing, you know he's a serial killer, but the movie doesn't tell you that immediately. I like that it's baked into the premise in and of itself.
Yeah, and I like that we set up the relationship between him and Riley before we get to this moment. So
right.
Yeah.
Because that's how he would see it.
Exactly.
That's how this guy would see it. That's kind of also my slight defense for the some of the weird, like, oh, that's not actually, like, teenager dialogue. But I think that is how Josh Hartnett's character would perceive it. It wouldn't make sense to him, but that's... I'm stretching just a little bit, I think, but that is slightly stretched. But that's how I feel.
Mike, what do you think about this reveal?
Well, I knew that was the premise going into it, and in fact, I was, like, very fascinated to see how you make a movie where an unrepentant serial killer is the main character, and not just the main character, but by the very structure of the story, someone who we want to see escape from the trap. Not in a moral sense, we don't want him to go out and kill more people, but as the protagonist of the movie, we need him to not be caught immediately. So we have to root for him to not be caught. And I was like, how is that gonna work exactly with someone who's so unrepentantly evil? And so I was really fascinated by that. I think that's one of the reasons why I was most excited about this.
Yeah, it's the Dexter paradigm.
And
yeah, but without even having, like, you know, him having a vigilante aspect.
Mm-hmm. I also like the music being done here. We have some strings by this composer. It brings me some memories of Bernard Herrmann, which, of course, is what he was going for. But we'll be hearing a lot of this as we go as well. So I think in addition to the actual music that is in this movie, I think the compositions, which, you know, Shyamalan has always had good composers work on his films, and this is no exception. I like the music to this a lot.
Yeah, it's a good classical kind of horror movie sort of symphonic sound to it, which I miss from movies. I feel like a lot of movies are not willing to do that.
So Cooper is stopped by Jody's mom, who says that she hopes Riley and Jody can remain friends, and she says that she spoke to Jody, and she says she promises to include Riley in more things. Man, do we need the... I guess we did need this plot for Where It Goes. We cut to outside as we see Haley Mills get out and head to the building. Haley Mills, by the way, was the star of the original Parent Trap. Yeah, that.
Holy shit.
Yep. Not
layers within layers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Not coincidental. Lady Raven, we'll get to her character later. Lady Raven, she gives a speech about releasing pain, and she tells the audience to picture someone who hurt them and tells them to release that pain. And she has everyone pull out their phones and turn on their light before going into her next song. I think this is a great visual, especially the fact that, and Mike, you already pointed this out, but the fact that... that Cooper's just kind of standing there as all these girls have these phones up, and he's just like, well, this is interesting. What do you think?
And I think that's one of the reasons why it had to be this kind of singer, too. Like, because you could, in theory, do this movie with any kind of concert. It could be a rapper. It could be a, you know, it could be a country singer. It could be Bruce Springsteen. But... which would be weird. But I think it has to be, like, a young... pop singer who's has a very young and very female audience, so you can have 6'3" or however tall he is, Josh Hartnett kind of lumbering over all these people and like feeling kind of like a monster in their midst because they're so much smaller than he is.
That disparate element of him feeling out of place, independent of being a serial killer, I think that's purposefully well done. But to Mike's point, it absolutely should have been Springsteen because this takes place in Philadelphia.
You know, you got a point there. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could just remake it. I mean, you know, not us. That
you have $30 million.
You know what I mean? Maybe it could be remade.
You have $30 million.
You do the inverse, where it's the dad dragging his daughter to his favorite band.
There you go.
She's really right.
And he doesn't even care that he's going to get caught because he's just like, no, he's going to do Jungle Land.
Cooper glances up and sees some movement in the crowd, which seems to annoy him. They then go to the t-shirt stand to get a shirt, and this particular stand only has one small shirt left. The worker says that he promises to get more, and Cooper just needs to come back later to pick it up. The vendor then tells Cooper that the police cars outside are there to trap the butcher, serial killer that has killed 12 people, and the whole concert is being set up to trap him. He says they're watching all the exits, and the only way to get out is through... backstage. Lots of things going on here, lots of exposition, and of course M. Night's shooting this from Cooper's point of view. There's some things about this scene I don't like, but what I really do like is the way Hartnett's playing it. Just the way he's like, really? Oh, that sounds awful. I love his expressions while he's talking to this vendor, and this vendor does a really good job too. What do you guys think of this scene?
It's like he's channeling Nicolas Cage.
A little bit.
I feel like Snake Eyes is the better version of this, this movie.
Oh, interesting.
I was thinking of that a lot watching, cause, you know, because that movie's all about POV,
yeah,
and you know, it kind of got a nearly interesting premise. But I also feel like there's times in this movie where Shyamalan pulls back, unfortunately, from the absurdity. Whereas if he leaned more into the absurdism and just the leaps in logic you have to go on, I think this movie would have worked better. But because he tries to kind of play both sides throughout the movie, I don't like that he's also asking me to turn my brain off, because this is the first instance of me going, okay, this guy would not be spewing all this exposition to this to Cooper. And the fact he acts even the least bit suspicious, given what we find out in this movie, should have caused him cause for concern as well.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of those things where you're right, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. You know, there's that part, I can't take credit for this, someone pointed this out, but there's that part in Wayne's World where they're at the Alice Cooper concert, yes, and they talk to a security guard who I think is, if I remember right, is played by Chris Farley, I might be misremembering, but he basically lays out what all the information that they'll need for like the big climax of the film, and then they walk away and they go, huh, that security guard sure seemed to know a lot about this concert. That's kind of what I felt in this scene a little bit. This guy lays out the entire premise for Josh Hartnett. But I do think it's one of those things you just kind of have to spot the movie. Although I will say it is pretty contrived. I think the fact that they get it out of the way pretty quickly is important. But it is so contrived that there was part of me that's like, is the fact that he knows it's a trap part of the trap? Like, was this this planted in some way? Which is not. But part of me was like, is he trying to trick me? Is this a game? But I actually have some issues with this character. I don't know if it's the performance or if it's the writing. I guess it's both. But I have some issues with this character's performance. a little bit. I don't want to get too, things I don't want to get too inflammatory about. I think that some of M. Night's recent movies have had black characters in them who are walking on the wrong side of being very kind of broad comic caricatures, and I understand he's not doing anything that's like openly malicious or anything like that. I'm not accusing him of that. I think he sometimes relies a little bit too much on types,
mm-hmm.
and that can get into bad territory when it comes to, you know, depicting people who, minorities and just from backgrounds that are just different from him or things like that. So, I was kind of walking that line a little bit with this character right up until the very end of the movie when I actually thought it kind of went a little bit too far. But I don't want to dwell on that too much. I don't think it's like something that I need to like write a thesis about or anything like that. And I did find him funny in moments for sure, but there I was like, this is pretty broad.
Cooper goes out and goes and casually pushes a girl down the stairs to distract the police, and then goes to see the police cars outside.
This starts a trend in this movie where, you know how some of Shyamalan's movies, you know, you find out that the movie doesn't take place in the reality that you think it is.
Yeah.
I think this takes place in a world where nobody possesses peripheral vision.
Well, he's trying to do the Hitchcock tricks, isn't he? Like, he does this little push, and then we're going to see later he puts glass in this French fry oil to make that happen. Like, we're seeing it all from behind, you know, and he's got a pretty good cinematography. The guy who did Call Me By Your Name, you know, he's the one working the camera here, does some pretty good camera work. I'm liking the things he's setting up, but you're right. Like, some of it just kind of comes off as, how did anybody notice that?
That's my problem. Like, you can't have a movie where it's all about him outsmarting. Like, he's supposed to be like a serial killer MacGyver, but there's too many instances where he succeeds because people are not paying attention
mm-hmm.
or just completely oblivious, not because he's actually outsmarting the FBI. And in hindsight, and in comparison, the FBI must be run by Chief Wiggum in this universe.
Nice reference. So they go back to their seats where Raven invites Russ to get on stage, and they do a duet together.
Yeah, he looks like he's an extra from Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome when he shows up.
Meanwhile, Cooper looks at the platform from where Russ comes from, and he tells Riley that they should go down there to kind of see what it's like. She, of course, calls him weird, and he responds by saying, this concert is crispy. Hartnett's playing this so funny.
He's chugging gas.
This is the Shyamalan thing I've criticized about a lot of his movies, where the kids are always written to be more intellectual and sound more like adults than the adults in the movies.
Yeah.
Well, but the guy's panicking. The guy is like he hasn't had a good idea yet. He's like, really? That's what I thought was so funny. He has the most ridiculous, and you almost think he's going to do it, but it's like, no, it's not.
Yeah.
It's not going to work, man.
Yeah, and oh, okay, we'll get to that when we get into it. So Cooper takes one more look at the trap door and then heads back to the vendor. Now, Cooper leaves with the vendor to get the shirt, which I couldn't imagine happening. But he reveals...
Yeah, especially if he lets him accompany yes. him all into the storage closet.
Yes! Which, I've worked ballparks, I've worked concerts, and this doesn't happen.
That's the weird dynamic this movie never capitalizes on, in that it can't decide if it wants to be in a disparate, almost satirical, heightened environment, or if it's taking place in quote-unquote the real world.
Yeah.
Because like I said earlier, there's too many instances where leaps in logic drive me nuts, but then it also tries to play it like deathly serious where, oh no, he's getting by on his cunning and his deep instincts. You can't have that in the same movie where he can walk in a room full of cops as a guy who matches the profile, he's not being singled out because we see various shots in the movie of people being grabbed by the police for profiling,
mm-hmm.
but yet he can walk through completely unscathed multiple times. It's one of the reasons why I'm not going to go to the extent that Law did, but I thought this movie sucked.
Well, I'm not going to go that far, but what I will say is, I think in some ways, and Mike, you'll probably agree with me on this, I think Shyamalan's kind of pointing out that Cooper himself is trapped too, because now he's the serial killer who's trapped in here and about to get caught. I think he's trying to get caught. I think he feels trapped and he wants to get untrapped, so he's trying to get caught.
Oh, I don't think that's true at all. I think the trap is, it's a more of a, existential one, sort of, between, like, he can't be a good dad and be a serial killer who escapes at the same time, until he figures out a way that actually he can, which is both kind of contrived, but also I think it sort of gets clever, but that's kind of the trap, I think, is more like, I fully believe that if he could have abandoned Riley, you know, as soon as he realized what it was, he would have found a way out of there without getting, you know, caught. I don't know what it would have been exactly, but I think he could have done it. But it's sort of the thing of, like, he wants her to have a good concert. Like, that's the thing. It's like, he's a good serial killer and a good dad. Like, it's really, and he makes the concert of her dreams up until what happens afterwards. But that's, I think, the bigger kind of thing. Maybe there is an element of him wanting to get caught, like, subconsciously.
I don't think that comes into play until the very end. That notion.
Mm. You know what else he's good at, boys, is he's a good firefighter, because this is what he reveals, is that his job is a firefighter, and he takes a box of shirts down, and the vendor shows him a picture of pieces of someone on a bridge on his phone. He then reveals his code to get from place to place, which is Hamilton, which, by the way, they filmed this in Hamilton, Ontario, so there's that.
Oh. Again, this guy is just spewing information that nobody in right mind would be conveying.
I know. He then, and his job isn't in trouble enough, he gives a shirt away for free, and Cooper gives him back his pocket knife, which for some reason was played
up. I thought when he gave him the box cutter, he was going to stab him.
I did too. Like, for some reason, they're playing up this music, and I'm thinking maybe he's going to stab him, but no, he doesn't.
Yeah,
I realize now I'm literally wearing my Eras Tour shirt that I got at the concert. I hadn't planned.
Are you really?
The mention of the T-shirt, I'm wearing it now. I'm just realizing that.
Cooper uses the key card he stole to go see the SWAT team meet up, and he hears that their job is to take the butcher out of the building alone. Cooper says that he needs to check the coffee as he makes his way through, and he's asked where the sugar is. Matt's favorite scene.
Again, he walks in a room full of cops, yes. And nobody stops. Nobody stops.
But that's the fun of it. That's what it is. It's this big Midwestern white guy is like... Yeah. The dorkiest motherfucker. I mean, Josh Hartnett is not the dorkiest motherfucker, but, you know, he's conveying these, like, lame dad vibes. That's the whole humor of it, is that it's, like, that's the satire almost of it, is it's, like, the thing that he makes him feel, you know, like he's a target, which is that he matches the profile and is the serial killer, is also the thing that allows him to, like, charm people with his, like, Midwestern aw shucksness. That's the fun of it. It's, like, you know, it's that's what it is.
It's like poetry, it rhymes.
It's like poetry, it rhymes. It's like Joseph Cotton in Shadow of a Doubt, the great Hitchcock movie that this is actually kind of reminiscent of a little bit, with the idea of, like, the younger female relative and the older guy who's a serial killer. He's got that thing where if you watch the movie, it should be very obvious to the people that he's the serial killer, but people don't put it together because he's this charming, you know, this charming, likable, affable sweater of a person.
I can roll with that if the whole movie was that heightened and exaggerated. But there's instances where Shyamalan, I don't think, has the wherewithal to fully commit to that. Because in his mind, I think he thinks he's making something like Rope or some of those other more gimmicky type of Hitchcock films. But I don't think he has he doesn't have the intellect. I just don't think he has the skill to go back and forth. Like, Brian De Palma made this movie 20 years ago, I probably would have loved it. Or, not 20, 30.
I was going to say,
it's been a while since he's had his
I forget
prime.
It's 2024.
Yeah. I thought of another movie besides Snake Eyes, but I'll get to that when we get to the third act. So Cooper walks through and grabs a radio, and he's again stopped by Jody's mom, who says that he doesn't want to see her bad side, and she warns him again not to patronize her. This goes nowhere.
We gotta talk about the sheer fucking coincidence that in a concert full of thousands of people, he runs into the same person twice.
You know what? I've been in situations like this.
Come on, that happens.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I've been in situations like this. It does happen.
This is the kind of thing that I actually think the film captured really well, which is the idea of you see somebody multiple times in this thing, someone you don't know, or in this case, it's an acquaintance, you know, someone who's a parent of one of your child's, you know, schoolmates and everything like that. And you meet them, and they have not been having the same experience you've been having exactly, but later on down, it changes a little bit. I'm sort of rambling a little bit, but I think that this movie I gave it shit for setting being set during the daytime earlier, but there is something that's actually really captured about what the vibe is at one of these really big concerts where you are seeing a lot of the same people pop up again and again and again if you're not, you know, sticking to your seat the entire time. Mm. The ways that he has to keep making excuses to step away from the seats, at which his daughter calls out, she's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You keep leaving, because that's weird behavior. And it's the kind of thing that I think is what is the kind of, I said animating earlier, I think that's the kind of thing that's driving the movie, is these kind of social conventions that go on in these big settings. And actually, then this is why as soon as the movie leaves the concert, it kind of falls off a cliff.
Oh, we'll get there.
We will get there. We're going to get there. We all have to get there.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
So here's my question that I'm going to throw out there for you guys. Matt, I want to go to you first for this. Are we supposed to be rooting for Cooper here?
I think so, because the movie's very much in line with those making you root for the villain type of... I mean, look, we had a lot of these movies in like the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is very much a throwback to a bygone era of movies. Like, you know, even speaking of, like, De Palma, like, if this was played like Raising Kane with John Lithgow... I also probably would have loved it, but I do think you're supposed to, I think you're supposed to root for him in the way that you, like, on some level root for the Joker in the Dark Knight for the, you know, the chaos theory. Then that leads to issues that we will get into in the third act, which we've been really teasing.
Mike, what about you? Do you think we're supposed to root for this
guy? You do root for him. You root for him the way that I described it earlier, in that the premise of the movie requires you wanting him not to get caught. It's an immoral rooting. It's a rooting that's based on you as the spectator of the movie and not as a human being with a moral compass. And that's how movies work. The moral compass thing is very, like, that only tangentially comes into people watching movies. There's a moment we know M. Night loves Psycho. I've already brought up, Hitchcock, and I've already brought up Shadow of a Doubt earlier. I'm going to bring up Psycho, which I think is one of the greatest films ever made. I think it's Hitchcock's greatest film, and I think that, I'm sure it's a film that M. Night Shyamalan has seen a million times. And there's a moment in Psycho that is pretty famous, and it is the key to the whole movie. So I'm going to just ramble for a bit. In the movie, obviously, Anthony Perkins plays Norman Bates, who is eventually revealed to be a serial killer. But even before you know that he's a serial killer, you know that he is covering up murders. And about a third of the way through the movie, he kills the ostensible protagonist of the movie, who's played by Janet Leigh. And with her dead body, he's disposing of it. He gets rid of it, wraps it up, puts it in a car. He's got to get rid of all the evidence that she was ever at his motel. He puts it in the car. He takes the car out to a tar pit and has it sink into the tar pit. And he's watching the car sink into the tar, and it's sinking and sinking slowly, slowly and gradually. And then there's a moment where the back of the car is sticking up, and it's stuck, and it's no longer sinking into the tar. If you see that movie with an audience, if you see the movie by yourself, you catch your breath in that moment when that car stops. And the reason why is because Hitchcock, and this is what he weaponizes in that film, but really it's just an underlying trait of really all narrative filmmaking. Hitchcock knows that as the audience, you want to see him get away with this for as long as he can, because that prolongs the enjoyment of the film. And so when you think that the car is not going to sink into the tar and that he might get caught, you don't want that to happen. And your sympathy, that's the key moment in the entire film, because it shows that your sympathy has shifted entirely from the victim to the murderer, or, you know, before you understand it, the guy who's covering up the murder. And what Shyamalan, in comparison, is doing with this movie is basically he's starting you off with Norman Bates from the beginning. There's not really a fake out other than there's 10 minutes where you don't know that he's a serial killer, but you still know that he is the main character of the movie. And that is the engine that's running this film for the first 45 minutes, for about the first half of it, is watching this guy, and you don't root for him as any kind of heroic character, but you root for him as the protagonist of the film. Your whole engagement with the film as a motion picture is with this guy needing to escape from this trap. And in the second half of the film, he does exactly what Hitchcock does in the second half, or in the back third of Psycho, where he shifts once again the perspective, this time away from Norman Bates and to the characters played by Vera Miles and John Gavin. And so now he can serve as the villain again. you were kind of rooting for him, even though you knew he was a killer or at least was a bad guy. Now he's got to be the villain again. That's exactly what Shyamalan does with Cooper in the last section of this film. And that's where this film goes wrong, is that it pins the perspective on someone who's not really capable of holding it, and then on someone who, as an actor, is totally capable of holding it, but as a character, there's a dramatic problem there. But we'll get to that. I kind of just gave a little bit of a lecture on Psycho in the middle of this episode on Trap, but I do think that that's really, like, the question of are we rooting for him in this movie is, like, key to understanding this movie. Not even on a thematic level, just on a procedural, structural level.
God, I still want to watch Psycho now.
I mean, it's fucking good.
I haven't seen
it. It's fucking good.
Yeah.
I prefer Psycho too. I'll put that out there.
Oh, wow. Cooper is now hearing instructions from the FBI on the radio, and I don't know about you guys, but I can hear sounds from my headphones no matter how loud the concert is. Cooper scrolls through the map, and he says that he forgot something else at the shirt stand, and Riley wonders why he keeps leaving. Cooper's hearing that he's going to be causing a panic as he reaches for the fire alarm. He sees some French fry oil and overflows it with glass until it burns a girl on the line.
Nobody saw this.
Nobody's seeing this at all.
Like this movie, this movie will entirely depend. Your enjoyment hinges on your ability to look past all the contrivances and conveniences. And unfortunately, I'm not one of those people who can do that in this concept, which is why I'm harsher than both of you.
Yeah, you know what? I'm not going to say I don't turn on this movie, but at this point, I'm still kind of going with it, no matter what he throws at me. Because I'm kind of with Mike, where I do see this as, he's playing it up as satire, not necessarily as master of suspense stuff.
Yeah, I think this is probably his most comedic film since The Visit. I think that's kind of the way that this works, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it is kind of satirical, the idea of, like, how far can this guy go just by being nice, basically? Just by being, like, a polite dad,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
I mean, the guy tells him all the shit about it being a trap, you know, he, like, does the right thing, and he's like, oh, and so he's like, yo, that was really great, man. So, like, that is kind of key to even that. Like, the fact that he learns that it's a trap by ostensibly acting like a good dad. Because he is a good dad. He's a nasty person. He's a good dad.
I'm going to harshly disagree and say this movie has, unfortunately, a lot of the tonal inconsistencies that I thought Old had.
Tonal inconsistencies?
As in... I feel like Shyamalan should have picked a lane.
Okay.
Where Old, there's parts of that movie that are genuinely disturbing, and then there's other parts where it borders on being as funny as The line reads in The Happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there is kind of a similar instance here, because there are line reads that are hysterical, but then I'm also being asked to take this movie deathly seriously in the third act.
Yeah. So Cooper takes off his coat and puts on an apron as he runs into some cops on the roof. He tells them that he freaked out at the kitchen accident and came outside for some air. He then gives them the code Hamilton, and he's told that the woman running the show is the best profiler in the world.
Apparently not.
Yeah. We see the girl on the stretcher as Riley states that she's been concerned with how much Cooper's been gone. And then after Cooper goes back to Riley, complete with the jacket, I guess he put back on after he put down. I was like, did I miss the scene where he grabbed his jacket again? We then hear that Raven picks one girl to be her dreamer girl, and they'll get to join Raven on stage for a song as well as go backstage. This, of course, perks Cooper's eyes right up. Now, here we go. We then get the M. Night cameo, who is so gullible here that he buys Cooper's leukemia story and lets the two of them backstage. You know what I like about this, boys? Instead of playing someone who is going to save the world with his stories like he did in Lady in the Water, he's playing the douchebag who lets the criminal to the only place he can escape. I thought that was kind of clever.
I thought it was good, too. This might be his best cameo, actually.
I agree.
It's the most, like, yeah.
Uh-oh.
I don't like that, of course, he's the fucking uncle.
Well, who else would he be?
The dad.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, he could have been the vendor.
Yeah, he could have been the vendor.
But this is one area where I think that, like, the idea was good, the execution I think is bad. Because I do like the idea of, oh, the only way, like, he thinks he can get out of this is if he literally gets, like, spotlight. Not him, but his daughter, you know. So, like, him getting out of the situation actually requires him being the best dad ever. Like,
yeah.
Like, getting his daughter this dream moment. And, like, it's actually kind of, that is something that, I think Justin Bieber used to do something similar to this. And he doesn't do that anymore. And, you know.
Pretend he had leukemia?
No, no, yeah, no, God. No. So he used to pick a girl from the audience. This is back before he was an adult. He used to pick a girl from the audience and, like, put her on stage and, like, sing to her, like, which is, like, the dream for every, you know, preteen girl in the audience and everything. And so there's anybody, any Swiftie would love to be pulled up on stage at any point during the concert, which I don't think has ever happened. But as a version of that, I think that's kind of a fun idea. I don't like the execution that it literally takes him about 2 minutes to engineer it happening.
Yeah.
I don't mind him finding the guy who's the spotter, the uncle, and getting a sob story about his daughter and successfully getting them on stage. I don't like how quick it happens and how easy it happens. If there had been some indication earlier on that he had seen the M. Night Shyamalan character as, like, a potential VIP and, like, had clocked him from the beginning as, like, a guy who is not just a normal spectator, but is someone who might be involved in the show in some way, then I would have bought it, or not just bought it, but I would have, like, gone with it more. But as a moment, I think, good idea, weak execution.
I just don't like that, again, he gets out of the situation through convenience, not cleverness.
But it is clever. He comes up with the
leukemia story.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course it's the uncle.
That's sure, well, that's, yeah.
What do you guys think about the way this is shot? He's doing a lot of POV shots here, and that's an M. Night style that I hadn't really seen until this movie.
Yeah, he does a lot of POV shots. His style of directing in general, I think, is pretty, like, across his filmography, is pretty, like, subjective.
Uh-huh.
You know, he wants to place you in the perspective of whoever the main character of the film is, generally, and I think he goes further with this one than he has in a while. We keep hinting at it, because this movie really takes there's a huge problem in this movie, which involves the shift in perspective.
Yeah.
And you really can't read the movie without talking about that, unless you think it all works. But I don't think anybody could think that every scene in this film is equally good, or that every performance in this film is equally good, and leave it at that for the moment, and only for the moment, because I'm sure we'll get there in just a minute.
Mm-hmm.
What is frustrated, and this is what pissed me off the most, is that I think this shows that Shyamalan has actually, I don't know if matured is the right word, but he's honed his craft more as a director. Like, I'm starting to see, you know, I think some of the tracking shots he uses in this movie are really effective. The POV frame of reference stuff, I think, is incorporated pretty well. This is one of those movies where I really wish someone else wrote it.
I kind of feel that, yeah. Not fully wrote it, but, like, at least a co-writer.
Yeah, someone who could have really fleshed this out and made it much more of something a little bit more cerebral. You can still have it be heightened, but I really think he needed someone to do some punch-up or, honestly, to overhaul the last third of this movie.
Well, it goes back to what I said at the beginning of this film, beginning of this podcast, in that this was the fastest script he'd ever written. And I'm with you guys. I do think it shows.
I guess. I don't know. I mean, I feel like I read that as well in the Wikipedia page. It was like, this is the at 5.5 months, it was the fastest he'd ever written a script. And I was like, I'm going to make another Seinfeld reference. But there's a moment in Seinfeld where Jerry is training a chicken to be in cockfights. And he's like, oh, he ran down the hallway in, you know, 10 seconds. And George goes, is that good? He goes, I don't know. I don't know if him writing a screenplay in 5.5 months is impressive or not. I mean, I don't think this is the strongest screenplay in the world, but some of his other screenplays are a lot worse, so I don't know. Like, you know, so I don't know if the problem is that it was written too quickly. I mean, I think maybe he just needed a co-writer to point out some of the issues, and also maybe needed to recast a certain key role. But the direction, I'm with you, Matt. I think this is probably his best, or not his best necessarily, but, like, I don't have an issue with the direction of this film, I think, at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really trying to think of a single moment in this film where, like, I'm like, the camera was in the wrong place, the perspective was wrong necessarily. It's in the writing, and it's in one performance, and both of which are really big deals. Writing and a key performance are big deals. So this is why it's not. It's far, far, far from a great movie. But as far as direction goes, I really think this is good work from him. And I think he doesn't even indulge in some of the maudlin qualities that you sometimes get in his films. I think even the ones that are good, I think sometimes can push a little bit into the sentimental. And I think this film is actually kind of anti-sentimental, which we'll get to. But
I, in fact, for the record, I did not read that on the wiki. I actually heard him say it on a Real Blend interview, I believe. He was interviewed on either the Real Blend or Empire, one of those two podcasts. I'm with you, Matt. I do think there's some things here that really needed to be punched up. So Riley gets some instructions on what she's going to be doing when she goes on stage as Raven calls for the Dreamer Girl to join her. And this goes back to being trapped. Yes, later Raven will literally be trapped, but here she's trapped as a singer here to please. So, and I do feel that in this stage show.
Leap in logic. The daughter should know how this works if she's that big of a super fan.
Yeah, but they'd explain it to her anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, they have to explain the protocol in order to do it. This, of course...
You're finding stuff that's not stuff.
Yeah, I mean, look, this movie just pissed me off. I can't lie.
It's unbelievable to me that, of all the movies we've done, Matt, the ones that have really pissed you off have been M. Night movies. We go from Lady in the Water to Knock at the Cabin to this. You are...
Don't forget After Earth.
After Earth. Yeah, you got kind of angry on that one as well.
Yeah, but like, this movie didn't make me angry, though. This is not a Knock at the Cabin situation.
Okay, well, you sound pretty angry.
No, I'm frustrated because I think this, if he brought someone else in, could have been one of his best movies. But I think, much like Lady in the Water, he let his ego get in the way of a lot of this, which explains why his daughter is such a big focal point.
This, of course, is a kick in the face to those who were making fun of Riley at school, so she's getting a little bit of payback here.
That's just the best dad ever.
Exactly. As Riley's on stage, Cooper's keeping a close eye on the profiler. We then cut to Cooper helping the girl who burned herself, and he's being told that how big of a gem he is, that he really helped them when they needed it. He sees Raven taking out an inhaler, as well as Kid Cudi treat people in the building like shit. And God knows I've seen this a ton of times. Recently at the resort I work at, we had Nelly and Flo Rida perform. Nelly was cool as hell, actually. Really nice guy. Flo Rida? He told everybody you could not look at him.
Garrett, this is exactly what I wanted to hear.
So, oh, God.
So you're saying that everyone had to look low at Flo Rida?
Nice.
Whereas people were content to ride with Nelly.
He would go to the cage to get cash for table games, and he would tell everybody, don't look at me, as he was kidding him.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, with his entourage.
And I'm sure people wanted to bitch slap him right round.
Oh, yeah. Cooper gets permission to go through backstage in order to go back to his car as cops continue to patrol the area. The profiler, meanwhile, she gets back on the radio and says that she thinks she's getting closer to identifying the butcher, and that she guarantees one of them will be talking to the butcher before long. Cooper is told that he's going to have to go through some patrols before going back to his car, and then watches a rundown of the entire situation with the profiler and Raven. Again, Matt, not getting caught, right?
FBI profiler. Did she get her degree in forensics out of a cereal box?
Apparently she's caught a lot of people, which is, they keep building her up as that, but I'm not seeing her really being a presence.
The only people she caught were the idiots that Chris Hansen caught on To Catch a Predator. Who were the most oblivious people known to man.
Well, I just imagine that there was, like, was there anyone in the FBI who was like, who the fuck, like, I know she's supposed to be, like, a brilliant profiler, but you watch these scenes and you imagine there's some FBI agent who's like, hey, can you shut the fuck up for a second? Like, can we... I don't need you to do, like, poetry about this guy or whatever. You know what I mean? I don't need you to, like, write the back cover of the book you're going to write about him. Like, can you shut up for a second, please?
She feels so perfunctory and underwritten. She reminds me of the therapist character from Split.
That's a great call.
Well, it's one weird that this isn't Betty Buckley, again, just because, like, he's worked with her a bunch of times. The way that this character is, like, presented, and perhaps I'm the crazy one in this one, part of me was like, is she his mother? Like, is that going to be a twist? Because there's some thing that they, like, throw out kind of early on, or at some point she says something about the butcher having a relationship with his parents or something like that. I don't think I'm making this up. I'm pretty sure this happens.
No, they mentioned maternal issues.
Yeah, yeah. And so part of me was like, is this going to be some sort of final twist where she's his mom? And so, which wouldn't have been a good twist, to be clear. But I really was trying to figure that out. Like, is this some sort of familial thing? No, it's not at all. She's just Haley Mills.
And Haley Mills,
she's kind of symbolically his mom, though. I think that that's kind of what they're sort of getting across, kind of. It's a really half-baked idea.
He lays that on really thick at one point.
Mike, I...
Kind of.
Mike, I do think you were really helping this script by calling that out. But I do think the whole thing of hiring Haley Mills is because she was in the Parent Trap.
He's the parent of the trap.
And Haley Mills did say, you know, she came out of retirement recently. You know, she's been in a few things in recent years, but she really enjoyed being on the set. She loved working for M. Night, so M. Night might use her again.
Yeah, because she didn't have to do shit.
That's the thing about actors who work with M. Night, though. They all come out saying they liked working with him. Well, except for Mark Wahlberg. Yeah.
But that guy seems like he's very chill and works easily with people, that Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah, right. Not explosive at all.
Yeah, I'm sure he's also inviting Tim Burton to his birthday party.
I know we're getting down a fucking rabbit hole, but it's so weird that Mark Wahlberg made a Tim Burton movie. And that Tim Burton made a Mark Wahlberg movie.
We covered it earlier this year. Cooper tells Raven that he needs to talk to her. They get to chatting about Riley as Cooper brings up what carbon monoxide does to the body. He then says that he thinks that she's looking for him as he shows her the boy he has trapped.
All right. I thought, because I expect twists in a Shyamalan movie, like I expect to see lens flares in a J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie. I thought the twist was that was like her brother or something.
Oh, interesting.
Like, it was going to be something really absurd, that either she knew him, or the twist was going to be that, bear with me for a sec, what if Riley was the serial killer?
Jesus.
Well, I know what you mean, though, because, like, there is part of you, maybe you didn't have Garrett since you didn't know that the premise was that he was the serial killer, but... I know I'm not the only, because I've heard other people say this as well, where they were like, I went into it thinking, like, well, he's the serial killer, but is the twist going to be that somehow the daughter is involved, that she's the killer somehow, that, like, when the wife comes into the picture, part of me was like, is she the killer? And he's covering, no, that doesn't make any sense. But, like, part of you naturally does that, of, like, trying to figure out, like, trying to question the, like, fundamental premise of the movie. And that kind of starts coming into play around here.
Because this is really the first Shyamalan movie I can think of where it doesn't have a major twist.
Yeah, I was thinking that, too. Yeah, it's a procedural.
I don't know if it's the only one. I think that some of the other ones maybe don't count, but...
But think when Shyamalan became Shyamalan from The Sixth Sense on.
Sure.
Outside of Last Airbender because he was adapting source material, I mean, the twist for that is he took a steaming shit on that source material. But all of his other movies have some kind of big reveal or thing that recontextualizes how you view the movie, like Split, for example, tying it into Unbreakable, that's the big twist.
Yeah.
But
Old has its reveal of what was happening all along. You're right, this one's not very twisty. It does have one thing, but it is less of a twist. It's more of a character.
It's also something I thought was very obvious. So it didn't really take me by surprise. Like, I was waiting for this movie to go to the level of Mother Nature is mad at us and is murdering us all. Or something like, look, this movie is narcissistic already. I thought he was going to go to the next level where her other sister comes in and they do, like, an actual Parent Trap where there's two of them. And the sister's working with the FBI. Like, I was waiting. I wanted this movie to just go, he's a very naughty word, to quote Robert Downey Jr., I want this movie to go full retard, and it never does.
You know what I thought of, though, guys? Again, this goes back to my metaphor that I brought up at the beginning of this. I think M. Night Shyamalan feels trapped as a filmmaker. I think he felt trapped in those early years of having to come up with those third act twists, and I think this movie is kind of his statement saying, you know what, I'm not going to be just that guy. I have other tricks up my sleeve, too. Now, whether those tricks work or not, we'll get to, but I do think that is part of why Shyamalan wanted to play this movie like this.
I feel like he already got that out of his system with Knock at the Cabin.
Not really. That had a twist to it.
It did, but it's also an adaptation, so he can say, like, I mean, granted, he changed a lot. He took a lot of liberties, as we talked about. But I guess the only one, now that I'm thinking about this, After Earth doesn't really have a twist.
No.
I guess.
But that's a Will Smith movie. That's not an M. Night movie.
Yeah.
That's true. Like, the fact that Shyamalan is credited as the sole director is the biggest example of the DGA being full of shit.
So Cooper says that he'll let this kid Spencer go if Raven allows them to ride in her limousine with her. And you know what? I'm going to say, you know, up until this point, I was having a decent time with this movie. As silly as the premise is, I liked seeing how Cooper got out of each situation. So the first hour of this thing, I'm with Mike, I thought it was pretty fun. But it is from this point on, boys, that I was getting a vibe from another movie that had a very successful and tense setup, and in its final act took a massive plunge.
Signs?
No. I was getting major Red Eye vibes from this thing.
Oh, wow, you're right.
I haven't seen that.
Mike, if you haven't seen that movie, it's basically, the setup is Rachel McAdams, she meets Cillian Murphy, they have a nice conversation, they get on the plane, and then Cillian Murphy reveals himself to be a killer, so she has to do what he says, or else he's going to send word to kill her family, her dad, or something. When it's on the plane, it's actually pretty good. Once it gets off the plane, that fucker sucks.
At least this movie doesn't turn into a stupid action
no,
movie.
No. And I know that's what you were going to say, but I just think, as far as a third act goes, as far as a written third act, this kind of takes that kind of a plunge.
Yeah, and this is a thing that it can be done well, I think. I'm trying to think of examples off the top of my head of like movies that kind of have a really high concept premise and then sort of have to switch out of them. I guess the thing I was sort of thinking of was Speed.
The whole idea
of Speed is, oh, bomb on the bus. And then there's like 30 minutes left when they're off the bus. So, like, they have to come up with a whole third act that doesn't have anything to do with that. And I don't know if that third act is as good as the bus parts of the movie Speed, but it is good. And the movie doesn't let up its energy. And yet, there are movies that try and do that thing, and it doesn't work. And this is one of them. Once they leave the concert, the air gets out of the balloon.
Pretty quick.
And it's a problem because, I mean, it's obviously a problem. And one of the reasons it's a problem is that the net kept getting tighter around him as the concert went on, and he was making it get tighter on him, with the idea being that the tighter it gets, the more he can get out of it. And once he gets out of the concert, just physically, structurally, there's a ton of tension lost. And I started noticing a lot more. There's a lot of intentional humor in the first part of the movie, and the audience that I saw reacted with it intentionally, like with the humor. I noticed a lot more laughing at, or like, maybe not laughing at, but I noticed a lot more laughter in the second half of the movie, even at things that I don't think were meant to be intentionally funny.
You might,
amongst my audience.
You might have heard Matt.
And this is also where the movie makes a big POV shift, where at this point, instead of following Cooper as the protagonist, we're now following Lady Raven.
Oof.
An interesting idea. It doesn't work. I'm just going to be upfront right now. Salika Shyamalan can't act.
Yeah.
It's just really obvious. There are times we've talked about performances on this show where, Cameron Diaz in Gangs of New York. That's a professional actor who is giving a bad performance because it's not their kind of movie. They're not totally sure what they're doing, but it's a professional performance. It's a professional actor giving a performance that's not good. There's other examples where someone is a capable actor, but they've miscalculated something about the performance. They've gone too big. This is a case where someone who's fundamentally not supposed to be a screen actor is asked to carry a big portion of this movie, and she is quite frankly incapable.
Yeah, and this is when Matt's rant at the beginning of this thing really hits me, is this girl just, she doesn't have any presence whatsoever. She has stage presence. She's a pretty decent singer, but you know what? Once you get her in this situation, like, why go here? Why take her with you?
This just furthers my argument where if he left her at the concert, I don't think my complaint certainly would have been adamant, but this just accentuates it even further that she carries on through the entire movie. And to use your third act thing, I would equate this to World War Z, where I think that movie's really anticlimactic in the third act compared to, you know, I think the first two thirds, it's a pretty solid zombie disaster movie for what it is, and then it just peters out. This movie sputters out like a helicopter that got shot out of the sky in a John McTiernan movie.
Hmm. They get to the car and leave the building, and in this car, Cooper is playing it very cool until Lady Raven asks if she can go to their house in order to drop Riley off. Riley calls her mom excited, and they get on their way, all as Lady Raven doesn't take her eyes off Cooper. They get to the house, right, as Lady Raven tells her driver to wait here as she goes to the house and meets Rachel, Cooper's wife, and Logan, Cooper's son. Lady Raven walks in as Rachel goes over what they're having for dinner, and Riley asks to show her her room. God damn, this is stupid. Oh my God.
So when Riley made the phone call to the mom, because I was looking for something just to wake me up from my slumber, they were calling, like, the guy who buries the bodies, and it was all a ruse, and she's in on the killings. or I thought it was going to be, like, a fake phone call or something. And then Allison Pill showed up, and I'm like, oh, they're actually running with this. And he does have, he's able to hide the malice behind normalcy. But every time I see Allison Pill, I get pissed off because I have, you know, picturing someone you hate and trying to forgive them. Given how instrumental she was in Star Trek Picard.
Oh, yeah.
Two seasons. It's going to take a lot of time for me to forgive her.
Well, I didn't know that Allison Pill was in this movie because she's not in any of the advertisements, because the advertisements focus entirely on the concert, probably correctly. But, so I didn't even know she was in this. And I was, I saw her name in the opening credits. I didn't know who she was playing. And once she shows up, first of all, I like Allison Pill. I've never seen Star Trek Picard, I will admit that. But I've liked her and stuff. It was a very startling moment for me to realize that she is now old enough to play the mother of a teenager.
Yeah.
When I think of her primarily, I mean, she's been good in a ton of things, but I think of her primarily as the really cool drummer from Scott Pilgrim.
Scott Pilgrim, yeah.
Yeah, where she's really cool and, like, fun and young and cute and stuff. And she's still great and cute and everything here, but she's in full mom mode with the most mom haircut you could possibly imagine. So I might have felt some anger of the realization that 14 years have passed since Scott Pilgrim and that I'm no longer 17, but that's a whole other story. It's very strange what happens in this part of the movie, because you do sense that something is not right, and you're kind of right, but it not in the way that, like, this is what I'm saying, like, part of you, maybe it's just me, but part of me is like, is the mom also a killer? Is there something going on that's like, she seems so perfect, but what the fuck's going on? Like, you know what I mean? And part of me thinks that naturally is going to come when you don't show the mom for the first half of the movie and then suddenly she's there. Part of me thinks that there should have been, the first scene is them leaving the house or early on within the first 10 minutes, they make a call back to mom, hey, we got to the concert, just letting you know, or something like that, just so you see her and that's out of the way, and so that she doesn't show up like Matt Damon in Interstellar and, like, you know, kind of, you're just like, oh, okay. But, and it's kind of a shame. I think Allison Pill is actually really good in this movie, in terms of her performance, I think is actually kind of excellent. But it's sort of a shame, because by the time that she becomes the point of view character, which does happen, I think the movie does improve from where it's been. The reason it improves is because it was in the hands of somebody who was not capable beforehand. So, and the movie's lost a lot of energy and a lot of purpose by that point. So it kind of sucks. I think Allison Pill's good in this. It's a shame that she's, like, in the part of the movie that isn't good.
Yeah. Cooper goes to Lady Raven's ear as Shyamalan has a spinning camera going, and Cooper tells her that he will kill his hostage if she says anything, and he really doesn't know what she thinks she's doing. Rachel says that Cooper always brings her special things, and when Rachel asks how the concert was, Lady Raven says that the police found a receipt for this concert and knew that he was going to be there. And it is here where, I'm with you, Matt, I feel Lady Raven really drops the ball on this role. This exposition she gives is so poorly delivered. I feel bad saying that, because I hate saying it to first-time actresses, and, you know, she's not a child, but she's in this movie, she's playing a pivotal role in a movie where this is her first role, and yeah, she's the director's daughter, but man, she cannot deliver these lines.
It's Sofia Coppola 2.0.
I wouldn't say it's that bad.
I think it's worse.
Oh,
I think
really?
I think it's worse. Yeah. Now, Coppola had to do heavier dramatic lifting, and it's like a better movie, or like a more serious movie, so maybe she stands out a little bit more, but I think this is a more incapable performance.
Only
I would argue Godfather 3 is more of a comedy than this. but also, Sofia Coppola has the excuse of she was not originally supposed to play that part. Shyamalan wrote this for his daughter.
Yeah, he wrote
so
this for her.
I do put blame for her.
Only thing that solves this is Cooper offering to walk Lady Raven out, but Raven says that she wants to play one more song for them on their piano before she leaves. So as she plays, Cooper holds his phone right in front, and Riley drops her phone on the piano seat. Guys, are you guys feeling any tension here whatsoever, or is the air completely out, Mike?
I wouldn't say it's completely out, but just the interest in the film has kind of dropped significantly. I do like what happens, though, in terms of, like, how... Because what ends up getting him, or, like, what, you know, how she ends up getting the phone is that he's taping the whole thing, because of course it is. It's the perfect moment. It's the perfect moment to film your daughter having this, like, mm-hmm. sweet thing. So that's what ends up getting him is his dad instincts overcome his instinct towards self-preservation. And so I like that that's it ends up being his downfall here.
I'm waiting for something to take me by surprise. Like, I'm sitting there going, okay, clearly there has to be more to this story than what's being presented. Because I'm thinking through my Shyamalan catalog of like, all right, something crazy's got to happen. And then I was vehemently disappointed as it kept going.
I thought, given he did Sixth Sense and whatnot, I thought maybe something supernatural would happen here. But there's, like, nothing that springs up or anything. Like, this is just a standard thriller. And when you go through a pretty decent first two acts and you get to this, everything just feels kind of lifeless.
Well, I think there's a visual problem, too. I guess this is the one area. I said earlier I didn't have any issues with this direction. And I wouldn't say I really do, but I think there's a slight visual choice that I wonder if it was the correct one, which is that at this point the lighting, because it's still daytime and they're indoors, it's pretty bright, which contrasts with the concert where things are dark.
Yeah, good point.
And it kind of, you can do light and suspense at the same time, obviously, but I feel like going from dark into light without it being a really sickly light or something can be kind of a visual problem. I don't really think that's a huge issue or anything like that. I'm just thinking, now that I'm thinking about it, like, you know, about the tension totally, mostly being lost in this last part of the film, like, that might contribute or at least not help a little bit now that I'm thinking of it.
Lady Raven then says that she'd like a selfie as she grabs Cooper's phone and goes in the bathroom. And Mike, I didn't pick up on it, but you're absolutely right. Cooper's ability to be a good dad is what really leads to his downfall here. So great call there. And it is here where Lady Raven is completely trapped as she converses with Spencer, who is the boy that Cooper has trapped. She then goes live and gives info on where Spencer is being held while Cooper and his family are doing what exactly? They're kind of fighting out here, but he's not really fighting to get in the door. He's just kind of yelling.
Yeah, this is the moment he should have snapped and become Jack.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, this is the moment where he should just, he has his full mental break and he becomes just entirely unhinged. The fact she's able to do this, this is getting into that old territory where I can't take it seriously.
Yeah.
This is what I thought was so weird, was that they set up that he's a firefighter, which I thought was going to be why, I thought they'd be like, oh, he can break down the door really easily because he's a firefighter.
That's why he has an axe in the house.
Exactly.
Right, yeah, which doesn't come into play, and I don't think it's him intentionally subverting something or whatever. It's just odd, I don't know. But I thought the direction of this part was good in the sense of, like, you really don't know what the fuck's happening.
That's true.
I mean, part of the reason is that you don't know why he's not breaking the door down, and maybe he should. But yeah, so there is that tension to that, and it makes me really, again, wish that, like, someone with more talent had, or more acting talent had played that part, because they could have maybe sold the fear in that moment a little bit more.
Exactly.
I guess the reason why he's not breaking the door down is, but he does try to get in, so yeah, it's not really great. I guess the idea is that he's taking the family away, which does kind of get into, like, you know, the whole theme of the conflict between, you know, dad and killer.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he does try and break the door down at first, so it doesn't really make a ton of sense. It doesn't really work.
I also deduced who should have played this role. Maya Hawke.
She does do music. I haven't checked it out, but, yeah.
Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman's
here. Oh, it's their daughter. Okay. Lady Raven says that there's a young man in the basement and sends one of her followers to check on a house with a blue door.
Yeah, so now they're doing the Silence of the Lambs thing where there's two houses. Or the black phone where there's two houses.
Exactly. She then yells through the door that Cooper is the butcher as she hears more commotion going on. She then opens the door, and he requests his and all the phones that she has. Family isn't speaking anymore, and he says that they're leaving with the guarantee that his hand stays on her shoulder at all times. They then head to Rachel's car as Lady Raven tries using reverse psychology on him, saying that he could make everyone proud if he stops right now, and he says that he's going to do this one last kill and then kill himself, which is the only way he could ever stop. I think Hartnett's still doing good stuff, but it's just not written very well.
Yeah.
And it's too late in the movie to all of a sudden try to be thematic.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, and I was really worried that it was going to, like, she was going to do the Friday the 13th Part 2 kind of thing.
Put a sweater on?
Well, just she was just going to, like, inhabit yeah. his mother and, like, that was going to be the key to defeating him. And I would have hated that because it would have been unearned and completely, like, irrelevant from anything that was going on in the movie. So I like that it doesn't happen. I like that it fails, but it shouldn't even have been thrown in. Like, it shouldn't even have been something. And, like, the fact that he kind of, like, he monologues a little bit about, like, this is my design. Now, luckily, the movie doesn't, like, really dig into that for more than, like, a minute, but even a minute was a minute too much.
Exactly.
It's just, it's too late in the movie to be putting that in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Riley cries and asks what's going on, and he gives all his family reassurance before heading out. The SWAT team arrives, and they infiltrate the house after Cooper's already left. God, these dumbass fucking cops.
Oh, it gets even worse with the limo.
Oh, God. Yeah, we're getting there. So meanwhile, Cooper handcuffs Raven to the steering wheel as he does the criminal monologuing that Mike mentioned, and I hate so much in these films. God, I hate when this shit happens.
The only thing that would have made it worse is he said, as you know.
People start peering into the car as the SWAT team arrives, and once again, they're in, and Cooper is gone to be replaced by a SWAT helmet. Oy vey.
All right, so now he's got the ability to teleport.
Yes! Because yes. That car wasn't... Nobody had left that car. That car was right...
Nobody saw him get out of the driver's seat. He's surrounded by people.
Yes.
The cops are there, and he has the ability to, like... He does that thing from the Hitman video games where he knocks someone out, puts on their uniform, and can blend in.
So dumb.
This movie sucks. I'm sorry.
Mike, what do you think about this hilarious
This
plot
is
point?
A big issue, which is that you start to not know what he's capable of. You talked before about, like, during the early parts of the movie, there are some contrivances. There's, like, he gets lucky at parts and, like, it sort of requires people not seeing him doing certain things and stuff like that. This is where it gets into, like supernatural kind of territory, basically, where it's like, how does he... And once that happens, it's a problem, and there are times when making, like, logical sort of arguments about this kind of movie is misplaced. The problem is when it becomes something where you don't know what is possible within the world of the movie, because it's not playing fair with the audience, because it's, if what is happening can't possibly be something that's anticipated, then that's something that is outside the bounds of the game that you're playing, essentially.
Yeah. Like the third act of this movie, he turns into Hannibal Lecter from Hannibal.
Mm-hmm.
But he turns into the beast.
Oh, that too, yeah.
Lady Raven walks Spencer to safety before hugging him as the profiler talks to Rachel, who says that she doesn't want to be around people. I hear you, honey. We then see Cooper talking to Rachel, who says that she's convinced that this is all big mix-up, but Cooper gives clues as to how she couldn't find out about his double wife. She thought that he was having an affair. And, of course, this is when we get the Hartnett shirtless scene.
Very strange.
Yeah,
it was odd. Yeah, like, did Shyamalan forget that he's, like, what, 45?
Yeah. Yeah, this is not as awkward as Adam Driver in fucking Last Jedi.
At least Adam Driver's 10 years younger.
That's true. She reveals that she called the police to inform them that the butcher was going to the concert. She then goes to grab some plates for some pie. So we get this pie-eating scene, and Cooper says that he's never felt a rage like this before, as he missed his kids growing up because of her. He says that he's going to end this on a murder-suicide, as the tea is making a lot of noise. But, of course, the pie is drugged, so we get a projected conversation with his mom before he gets shocked by police.
Used repeatedly.
Yeah.
Is the pie... I thought it was laced with arsenic and he was just going to die.
I thought so, too.
He says it's not. That's not what it is. I thought that's what it was going to be, but it's better than that.
He's also a fucking idiot now because he never sees his wife take a bite, but he keeps eating.
But she does. She does take a bite. And she takes the first bite.
Well, as soon as she said, let's have a piece of pie before you kill me, now we're getting into the cliché, like, this is almost the James Bond thing of, hey, before you die, I'm going to monologue.
Yeah.
You can break out your gadget and beat me.
Mike, what do you think about this? You seem more open to it.
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, she starts eating the pie. That's actually, I made a note of that because I was like, if this is poison, then then this is bad writing because one, it's really obvious, and two, he would not have it unless she had some too. But she starts eating before he does, which is fine because it's like kind of a tranquilizer. It's for, you know, it's for him to stop them without, for him to more easily overpower them, which is exactly what happens. And it was something that wouldn't prevent her from being incapacitated if she eats it as well. She would be slowed down, but she wouldn't be poisoned or anything like that. So I don't have any problem with that. The cops tasing him is stupid as hell, but they would shoot him. I know that, like, they fucking shoot him in the head immediately. This is ridiculous. I know he's white, but they would still shoot him in the head. Like, I know from cops, and that's what they would do. So this is where the movie is really, because the problem is she's so good. Like, Alison Pill is so good in this scene.
She is.
And it ties into the whole thing of, like, she suspects that he's not a good husband and father, because she thinks he might be having an affair. He's not. He's not. He's a serial killer. Mm-hmm. Like, it's again, it's the thing. He's the best dad and the worst guy. Like, you know, and so, like, in theory, there's some really cool stuff here. But once, again, this is like, what, they take him down, and it's, I've seen a lot of movies lately have had the real problem of not knowing where to end, and this movie does feel like it keeps getting to the last scene like six different times.
Which is weird, because it's only about 105 minutes, so it's not like...
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's got like at least four false finishes in the last 20
minutes.
You're
right.
Yeah.
The profiler looks at Rachel and tells her that she's going to have her kids back soon. Cooper is taken out, and he goes to Riley's bike. More on this in a bit.
Oh, for God. This broke me. This was my... I couldn't believe that they let him do this.
We'll get there. Rachel screams not to shoot him. We see the kids come back to the house within, what, 30 minutes or so after leaving?
Yeah. Normally, your kids would be in protective services for a little while.
Yeah. We didn't see Cooper start picking the lock on his cuffs with the spoke he took from the bike as credits roll. So we might have a split situation where he could come back. What did you guys think about leaving this so open-ended?
I wanted to stab that spoke into the side of my neck and bleed out. It's like, I'm fine, but, like, this movie insults my intelligence way too many times.
Well, I do like your idea of a sequel. Maybe he could, like, follow the Grateful Dead around on tour. I'm guessing there's a lot of serial killers who follow bands around on tour. That's probably I don't want to malign Grateful Dead fans, but there was a jam band that came near where I live, and there were some vibes. But so I'm kind of conflicted about the very ending of the movie, because I understand that it's kind of meant to be like a fun, goofy, like it's like when a movie ends with the end question mark, like a Godzilla movie ends with the end question mark. Which I have seen, because that's just supposed to be kind of the idea, but, and the thematic tying in of it, like the thing of like him recognizing his daughter's a bike is actually the thing that allows him to escape, but it doesn't, it's just kind of, you run through this kind of thing so many times now that it just kind of doesn't really mean anything. It's a pretty weak ending. I don't think it goes disastrously wrong or anything like that, and unlike some other Shyamalan movies, ending doesn't feel thematically or tonally at odds with what was going on for the rest of the film, but it just kind of doesn't have an ending. He should die. I understand that, like, yeah, I mean, maybe that's more harder to watch or something like that, but I don't think so. I don't know. I think that he just needs to be shot in the head in that scene and have the ending of the movie play out in the kitchen, if that's how far you... If you want to take it to the house, then have it end in the house and not in the police car, I think. But,
well,
I don't know.
I'm assuming you guys didn't stick around for the final mid-credits scene.
Oh, I stuck around.
Oh, you saw it?
I was there.
All right.
See my popcorn? The popcorn was gone, but I was there.
Yeah, I'm assuming Matt just got the hell up and didn't even see this, but...
I stuck around because I wait for the crowd to leave before I...
See, I do the exact opposite. I get up and leave before the crowd. What happens here is we see Jamie learn the identity of the butcher from the news as he's watching it. So we do get a resolution of this vendor being so nice to this guy, giving him a lot of ways of getting out of that fucking place, and he's learning that it's the killer. But that's it for Trap. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Trap? Mike, you go ahead and go, sir.
This is an interesting one. It sort of raises the question a little bit of, like, what are you evaluating the movie on exactly, or like what makes the movie a success and or a failure. And this movie has elements of both, I think, for sure. It gets worse the more it goes along. It has some really disastrous elements in it in terms of performance. Some aspects of the writing I was impressed by, other aspects I was very much not impressed by. Yet, at the same time, when I think about this movie, what I think about is Josh Hartnett. I think about the fact that I was interested in watching what his character did the entire time. And I think about how that carried through from the first scene of the film all the way to the last scene of the film. And while I did have issues with the performance of Slake and Night Shyamalan, I had issues with the writing in the second half of the movie, I had a few other issues here and there, I think this movie's built around that guy, and I was never really, my interest in that guy never flagged. So I have to rate this movie as a success, I think, based on that. There are big issues with it. Whether they're big enough to overwhelm the things that I liked about it, I think are kind of different. So I think what I'm going to give this is about a 6 out of 10. Someone asked me the other day, I said that I saw it, and they asked me if it was good and if I would recommend it to them. And I went, yeah, I think so. So 6 out of 10. That's basically what that means.
Mike, your answer to that is listen to the podcast. That's what I tell everybody who asks me about these movies. I said, I'm not going to tell you. You got to listen. All right, Matt, unleash your fury, sir.
Well, the only reason I can't go full Poseidon and just drown this movie in a puddle, like Bruce Willis at the end of Glass, is because this is not the worst Shyamalan movie he's made. So I kind of have to grade it on a curve in the same way that you have to rate, like, the Fast and Furious movies on a scale, or like, Friday the 13th, as Mike alluded to. The thing that frustrated me the most is I think this could have been one of his best movies, and it's unfortunate that a lot of his technical prowess that I do feel is on display here are offset by the gross miscalculation of how he chose to showcase this movie. Feels like a Josh Hartnett showcase second, in my estimation. And that's unfortunate, because I think I've always said Shyamalan, his best performances come from great actors. Maybe I've underestimated Josh Hartnett, because I think this material is largely crap, and he kind of rises above it, which is an anomaly in Shyamalan circles. So while I was not in love with the first half, as I made emphatically clear, I didn't want to cut the concert off early and kill the power and go home for the night without a refund. Once they leave that venue, that concert hall, this thing craters like the end of a Godzilla movie. This movie looks like Japan after Godzilla destroys it, to the point where I almost can't even imagine myself revisiting this, because I felt like it was just squandered potential that kept unraveling like a giant ball of yarn as it keeps going. So that leads me to my score. And I have been all over the map with Shyamalan. I mean, I think Lady in the Water is the first movie I give a 0 to in the history of our show, Garrett. It's not that. I don't think it's the worst movie of the year, because I've seen Rebel Moon. I've seen Argyle. I've seen Imaginary.
Did you see Madam Web?
I did see Madam Web, but Madam Web, I laughed my ass off watching that. Like, that was my Catwoman. What Catwoman was for Garrett,
yeah.
Madam Web was for me, where I'm like, I'm having a blast because these filmmakers think they're making something great. And I think Shyamalan, to a certain degree, was sitting there behind the camera going, that's my girl. And somebody should have said, hey, I think we should go in a different direction. But I'll go in the consummate direction that Garrett might sue me for plagiarism war, because I'm giving this a 4 on 10.
4 from Mr. Goudreau. Not the first or last one you will give, sir. Oh, man. See, no matter what I have to say about this movie, let me just start this off by saying that, with the exception of a few adaptations that he has done, I like the fact that he is endorsing original filmmaking with outside influences. I think that is something that needs to be celebrated. This guy, no matter what you feel about his movies, you have to respect that he has built his own universe in a lot of ways. All that being said, I am pretty much in lockstep with Guarneri in that I think the first two-thirds of this movie is pretty solid fun. I was having a really good time seeing how this guy was getting out of each situation he was in. Getting the shirt and, you know, all these girls are holding up the lights, which I thought was a nice visual. I think there's a lot of technical prowess being displayed here. All that being said, the disastrous final act of this movie plummets my score. I think if Shyamalan had kept it as fun as he had it going, I think as Matt said, this could have been one of his best movies. But man, that third act and putting his poor daughter out there on display like that without a hint of acting lessons is a really bad decision made by our maestro, Mr. Shyamalan here. So I think Josh Hartnett is fun as hell. I love him in this movie. I really do. I think some of his facial expressions just are second to none. And I think him being in this really elevates it. I think the daughter's okay, but she doesn't really play too much other than, Dad, where have you been? Dad, what's going on? Dad, what's happening? And she's not even too much into the final act, except for the fact that she leaves the phone by her. Like, she doesn't really play into it. It becomes a Cooper versus Lady Raven final act, which, man, it just doesn't work. So that first two-thirds, though, is good filmmaking, and I'm with Mike. I'm giving this a 6. But God, no matter what M. Night does next, I know we'll be there, but I hope he just grabs somebody and helps him with what he struggles with, which he's great at the technical stuff, but get somebody who can write, get somebody who can do this dialogue, and get somebody who can act, and you would have had a really, really good film here. But as it is, 6 out of 10 for me. Oh boy, the last M. Night we're going to be doing for a while, hopefully, we'll see. The guy, as Mike has said, has been turning out these things left and right. Matt, where do you think he goes from here?
I think he'll stay in his own purview, and I think we'll get something original for him within the next 2 years. Basically, since he's come back, he's put out a movie every couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he'll have something in the pipeline long enough. I'll be curious to know what it is. But the last couple of movies of his, I feel like I'm back to square one with him.
Wow.
The last one of his I really liked was Split, and that was almost a decade ago.
Yeah, that's true. Mike, you came into this series originally having not seen the majority of the movies for the very first, until you did it for this series. What are you feeling now that you've seen his entire resume? Where do you think he can go from here? Does he take up, like, maybe a comic book film, or where does he go?
They wouldn't do that because those movies cost a lot of money, and he is not the kind of director that people will do that for anymore. The thing about him is he's very individualistic. His films are very distinctly his. You wouldn't mistake them for somebody else's films. They're not going to give him a $150 million movie and with like a franchise potential. They're not going to give that to him. The time that they did do that was The Last Airbender, and that was a disaster. So he's going to continue making this pretty successful in terms of, like, setting out to accomplish what, or, like, accomplishing what they set out to accomplish. Thing that he's been doing since The Visit of, like, make a low-budget film that has a very, like, kind of high-concept B-movie thriller plot. Maybe you get, like, someone who's a recognizable face in it and sell it in a kind of a doldrum month. August is actually not a doldrum month in the same way it used to be, but like Knock at the Cabin or whatever. And make enough money on the first 2 weekends to justify the release. He self-finances these films, and he's found a mode that pretty much works for him. I don't really see any signs of it letting up. This one just a little bit more expensive than some of his other ones, and he might downscale it a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, he's really, I think, career-wise, he's basically in the same place that he was after his last two movies. I mean, you know, it's he's been in a very steady kind of thing. I don't know what exactly he would need to do to, like, shake that up, unless he went, like, real low budget, and maybe that would happen, although I don't know what that would be. And if he went high budget, it would probably mean that a studio was financing him, and if that's the case, then I think the movies would be pretty different. He's just an interesting kind of guy, because he's quintessentially himself, and he makes films, you know, without feeling very compromised by anybody. I mean, when we talk about M. Night Shyamalan movies, it's not like talking about, fuck, I don't know, what's, you know, I didn't like the fucking Spider-Man movie that goddamn saved the box office or whatever, Spider-Man Far From Heaven Home, whatever it's called. Piece of shit. Who even knows the director of that movie's name?
I'm lost. Sure,
but you could have said anything. I mean, really, like, I knew it was John Watts as well, but, like, when you discuss that movie, you don't discuss John Watts.
It doesn't have a distinct feel.
When you discuss what's good about... Yeah, and when you discuss what's good or bad in a Shyamalan movie, you discuss Shyamalan. He's his own worst enemy. He's his own greatest saint. There's not many people like that left, I think, because...
I said the two big ones. I said Nolan, Jordan Peele. I will say the one thing I want to see him do for his next movie I want to see him direct someone else's script.
That would be interesting. He had, when he did that with After Earth, it was incredibly boring, though. So yeah,
After Earth, I can, that's a Will Smith vehicle.
Yeah, that's true.
But like everything else, he's either the solo writer or Knock at the Cabin, he co-adapted with two other people.
With,
right, right.
With what he does with Tension, I want to see him do a full-out horror film. Just go balls out. Don't make it the Earth coming to attack us. Don't do any of that shit. Just make a balls-out horror film. I would love to see that from him. But that does it for M. Night for now. And as we record this, Matt and I are in the midst of covering the Alien series, which is has been another interesting set of podcasts. We've been doing a lot of arguing this year, and those podcasts are no different. Tune in for those. And then immediately after, well, I'm not going to say what we're doing immediately after. Let's just say me and Matt are going to be plowing through a ton of corn after we're done with Alien. But until next week, this podcast slaps. Thank you, boys. I see danger.
You know the butcher? That freaking nut job that goes around chopping people up? The feds heard that he's gonna be here today.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
You're acting weird.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Cooper, Jamie.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Dad.
I'm sorry, Riley, what was that?
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
There's no way to get out of here.
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including The Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise, Star Wars, movies featuring the team-up of Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
This individual that we're searching for won't panic.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan. Is our son lonely with no neighbor
watching shadows? Yeah. I can't let the two lives touch, and I can't stop it.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
I'm sorry, Riley, what was that?
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Wouldn't it be unbelievable to see what's down there? See how they put on the show?
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental. Still she forgives
our behavior. Catch me.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
This whole concert? It's a trap.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
You're acting strange. Is something wrong, Dad?
No. I'm just excited for you is all.
I'll be right back.
Never felt this before.
Yeah, I think this is probably his most comedic film since...
What, The Visit?
Maybe The Visit, but... No. Yeah, I guess since The Visit, but honestly, this might even be more than The Visit, because with The Visit, at least, I don't know if... Yeah, I cut that last bit where I kind of rambled there. Sorry.
Never felt this before.
I also deduced who should have played this role. Maya Hawke.
She does do music. I haven't checked it out, but, yeah.
Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman's
here. Oh, it's their daughter. Okay. Lady Raven says that there's a young man in the basement.
Never felt this before.
Someone asked me the other day, I said that I saw it, and they asked me if it was good and if I would recommend it to them. And I went, yeah, I think so. So 6 out of 10. That's basically what that means.
Mike, your answer to that is listen to the podcast. That's what I tell everybody who asks me about these movies. I said, I'm not going to tell you. You got to listen.
Well, there's some, I watched a bit. You know what? It's done. I'm not, I'm leaving that on the floor.
Okay.
That's gone.
All right. All right, Matt.
Enjoy the rest of the concert.